All right, ladies and gentlemen, listen up. This is an awesome podcast. I can't wait for you guys to dive into this one. I love doing all of these podcasts. I hope that you guys enjoy listening to them. If you do happen to enjoy listening to them, share it with a like-minded individual. I don't charge for the podcast. You're not going to get a refund even if you didn't like it, because it's free to your device, whether you're listening to this on iTunes or Spotify. And all I hope is that you guys would share the show. Don't be a hoe. Share the show. I want to give a huge shout out to Racetech Suspension and Engine. Those guys are amazing. They helped me out in a big way. Looking forward to continuing to working with those guys in the future. And I'm getting my suspension done by them in the new year. The KTM is going to be sprung in a whole different way. No more air fork. Backyard design. No more going back and forth with a designer being like, hey, you didn't put that logo on the way I want it to. I don't like the color that you use for this particular panel. None of that. You do all of it yourself, and it's so easy to use. Even a bricklayer like me can figure it out. WeBig Moto Co., that's where you're going to find all of the amazing apparel with all of those logos that are clearly ripped off. I absolutely love it. They have zero fucks given to anyone who, any of these companies like Marlboro or Ferrari. They just put those on the website and they're for you to enjoy. Luxon MX. Improve your ride with Luxon MX, whether it's the linkage components or the triple clamps, or maybe it's just a set of bar mounts. You're going to have a much better feel of your motorcycle with Luxon MX. Same thing with WUSA. Let's be honest. The wheels that you're on your bike are probably egg-shaped, oblong, and looking pretty ugly. They'll be not looking so ugly if you get yourself a set of W wheels, and you can actually save, I believe it's 15% off of your wheel set by mentioning Big MX Radio. So I think, well, let's just say a set of wheels runs you about $1,000. That's $150 off, and that you can use that towards maybe getting yourself some Luxon clamps. Maybe you spend that money on some Fast Company handlebars. Good enough for the Bruff Brothers, which I'll be going down and hanging out with those guys in a couple weeks' time down in Mesquite, Nevada. Those guys run the Flex handlebars, and they go a whole lot faster than you. I can guarantee this, unless Ricky Carmichael are listening. I seriously, seriously doubt it, but welcome to listening to the show, my friend. Looking forward to having you on the podcast. Last but not least, Guts Racing, best seats out there. The seat covers, the complete seats. Honestly, one of my favorite things that I was able to do is get a complete seat for my motorcycle, and it was just plug and play, fit up immediately. Worked awesome with my graphic kit that I put on there. I did get a black seat cover because I'm pretty boring, but black goes with everything, so that's the way it goes. All right, guys, let's get to the pod. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. This is Racer's Mindset. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt, fresh off of my very first experience at World Vets. I have some things to say about that particular event, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But first, I have to introduce my co-host, and he was basically the big boss with the hot sauce in California this last weekend. He was pulling all the strings, even though he still had some sore ribs, and made sure that the bike was tip-top shape for me to put in a 33, 32, 29 finish in the intermediate class. And we're going to get to why I feel like it shouldn't have been called intermediate. But Andrew Hopson, Hoppo, how's it going?
Good, Brett. How are you? It was
my forearms are still a little bit sore from navigating the hills of Glen Helen. But yeah, it's Friday. We're recovering. And yeah, we're already starting to count down the days to come back and redeem myself. So no, we're not doing too bad. Plus, we happen to have an absolute legend of motocross on the line. Some know him as number five. Some of them more familiar with him as the 111. If you happen to be a Terra Firma fan, Danny Ham, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate getting me onto this one. I've been listening to a few of these, and it's been pretty exciting for the fact that I knew this was coming up. We've been trying to make this work over the last couple of weeks with timing, a bit hard from the other side of the world, but certainly happy to get on there now before I actually fly over to America tomorrow. So, yeah, it sounds good.
And I will make note that this is our first international guest. So, yeah, like nice. I said, logistically, time-wise, days, talk about the future, back and forth. So it's good to be able to get it done today.
Absolutely.
Let's get into it.
Danny is currently living in the future. It's Saturday where he's at. This is actually quite unprecedented. I don't know if there's another motocross podcast that would have three different nations on the call all at the very same time. And the fact that, like, this whole idea was thrown out less than 10 days ago and that we were able to coordinate all things together. And then I'll also throw a fourth nation in the fact that I've got Pedro Gonzalez jersey behind me. So, like, Mexico is also represented in this particular podcast. Hopefully for those watching on YouTube, they can enjoy that as well. Hoppo, this podcast series in general was your idea. Danny Ham was your idea. What brings us here today?
Well, I mean, Hammy and I have been friends for, 30 odd years. And I follow him on social media and he does a good job. And, you know, I was watching some of the stuff there, his presentation with the current Australian Supercross. So I figured that it'd be a good time to bring him in. Let's talk a little about, you know, how he got to where he was, what he's doing right now. And again, you know, he's had a pretty star-studded career and we want to dive into that. I mean, Motocross the Nations for Australia, he's raced all around the world Supercrosses. So let's just, you know, for the average guy that's thinking about it, let's just see what, you know, what it takes to be in that realm to be able to do that for so long and now reinvent himself as a commentator for Supercross. And I believe he's still a track builder pulling levers as well. So, you know, there's a little bit of everything to unpack there.
A man of many talents. So before we jump in the time machine and go back to all of the Terra Firmas and the 90s motocross that we love, Danny, what's happening right now? You've got your fingers into a lot of different things, including some travel and some magazine media stuff as well. It sounds like a juggling act, but that doesn't seem too far astray from your regular program anyway. Take us through it.
Yeah, so right now we're currently deep in the Australian Supercross Championship Series. That there is only over five rounds. We don't have as much Supercrosses we used to back in Hoppo's day. We used to have an enormous amount of Supercrosses that we used to do. I think one of our years there, we had 26 rounds of Supercross over multiple promoters across every state of the country, and you drove to every single one of them in a high ace. So it's not quite as big as it used to be back then, but we do have a pretty solid series that is happening right now. We've got some international flavor with Wilson and Savarchi and you know, a few other spatterings from around the world at this one. And my role there is basically the lead commentator at the moment, which that in itself came around at the last minute. I was actually meant to be the guy on the ground just giving the expert comments. But unfortunately, Lee Hogan, who was meant to lead this whole series, has got a bit of a health issue at the moment. And on the day, 9:30 on the day, I got told, hey, you're stepping into the main role. So that's where I'm at with that. Yep, not the ideal prep into it. Like Hoppo said, a little bit of track building as well, just more so being one of the gophers out there in the machines, helping out, doing what I can. And then whatever else I can within the motocross community, I do a little bit of coaching with BCP. Not enough. I don't have enough time in the week to be able to get out and do so much of that. As I said, heading over to America, that's for ADB magazine, Australian Dirt Bike magazine. That's to do the Triumph launch for the 450. I got lucky enough to do the 250 at the start of the year. So yeah, there's a bit going on, still involved in ways throughout the motocross community, but just as far as riding, really don't get enough time to do it. I think I logged 7 hours on my bike this year that I've just sold yesterday. So really not enough time for riding, but yeah, still involved, very heavily involved here in Australia.
Certainly. And one of the common themes, or I guess one of the leading themes of the early portion of that Australian Supercross series is that the whoops needed to get more gnarly. They needed to get bigger. And you broke the internet, as far as the motocross internet is concerned, by putting your skills where your mouth is by building a big set of whoops. And 7 hours on the bike or not, navigated the tops of those things pretty well. Take me through that and some of the backlash that you may have got from not only some of your countrymen, but, well, across the world.
Surprisingly, it's actually been pretty positive, most parts. I've got haters.
That doesn't sound like the internet, I know.
Yeah, we've all got haters, and I've dealt with them for many years, so there's always going to be those guys. Look, it was not so much at the time, and the the big argument with the haters is that they think I'm discrediting the skill levels of these riders. I'm not. I know how fantastic these top riders are in Australia. What annoyed me on the night was just seeing them after watching Dean Wilson blitz the whoops on the first round of our Supercross, that no one else stepped up to it. I know in my time that if I saw someone doing something that was quicker, that was better, and not by just a little bit, by a bloody long way, that you had to step up as a pro rider to go out there and be able to run those paces. So that's where the whole post started. And it wasn't to make the whoops bigger and better. The second night of our first two rounds, they were actually brought down to a size where the 80s, the 85s were actually blitzing across the top of them.
So they're non-existent then.
Yeah, they were still there, but they were so easy. And, you know, yeah. As a professional, everything on the track is meant to challenge you, right? So if these things aren't challenging you, everyone can blitz across the top of them. What's the point of them? So that was where the whole post came from. It was we want to see people step up, do what I know they could do. I know their skill set, and I know that they could have done it. They just chose not to. So yeah, that's where the post come from. It blew up bigger than I thought it was going to. I'd even heard a few of the top American riders had reposted it. There was a lot of likes and comments on it. And then, of course, the backlash from just the also-rens that think that they know best, or putting shit back onto me. So I thought I'd best get the bike out. I organized a set of suspension. Hadn't ridden Supercross in 5 years. Kept the sand tires on. And hit up some whoops with wet clay. So it was interesting. The first run through was pretty good. I've got to admit, I was bloody nervous going into it, but I got across them okay. There was some moments. I did about 20 laps and then packed it up, and there's my Supercross done for the year again.
Perfect. That is awesome. Now pack yourself up, and you are heading over to the States. In fact, this whole podcast would have been a lot easier to coordinate maybe a little bit later next week or something like that. But either way, going to spend some time on the 450 Triumph. You've got to be excited about that.
Yeah, I think the platform was pretty good from what I rode at the start of the year with the 250. And I'm looking forward to seeing if there's been any changes over the year. You know, they've had a whole year of racing and developing again. Or whether it's just going to be simply bolting a 450 into the frame that we already know, and how the characteristics may change with the bigger engine inside it. So it's going to be very interesting. It looks like a cool facility from what I've seen. The track looks like a bit of fun. So, yeah, definitely looking forward to that. Write out a few words and then fly straight back in. As soon as I land back here, go straight to Adelaide for the next round of the Supercross. Jump on board with that one. So it's a busy couple of weeks ahead of me.
Wow, that's a juggling schedule, man. My hat's off to you. Your brain might not know where you're at by the end of it, but you're going to have some stories to tell.
So yeah, I'm definitely going to be all mixed up.
Let's go back a few years, Hammy. Let's go back to the RM85 days. You're a young junior. I mean, you've got Craig Anderson, you've got Kim Ashkenazi, Gobert's in the same era. I mean, that was a pretty star-studded field back in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, Dave Feeney and I were traveling around in Ohio trying to make it happen as well. But, I mean, you guys were definitely the next level of that generation coming through, as we see generations coming through time after time. But let's go back a little bit. And I mean, you know, Anderson Rivals and Gobert's. I mean, there were some pretty good guys that made it outside of the country that, could have been good for a lot of people.
It was huge, that whole era, and it extended a little bit past us as well. When you start thinking about the Marmonts, the Reeds as well, they all grew up around that same era. So there was a lot of great riders that came out of that era. I don't know. I think it's probably the same if you look at it anywhere around the world. That 90s era had so many good riders, but especially for Australia being so small, to have that huge number of riders come out of it was pretty special. And I think it's, like you said, the rivalries. I think that's what it was. We all had our own internal battles, rivalries with someone out there on the track. And I think that's what really pushed us along to become the riders that we were. I know that Craig and I have spoken about it. You know, we're not best buddies. We don't make phone calls to each other every Friday night and say, how's shit going? You know, it just doesn't happen. But when we do speak to each other every now and then, you know, we have a respect for each other, that we know that that rivalry is what got us to where we were. And I think that's that's pretty key with any kind of sport that you're looking at, but definitely in Australian motocross at that time, that's what got us to where we were.
I mean, because you can also throw in there, you know, Matt Mladen and Casey Stoner, and we're all within a couple of hours of each other. I mean, Mladen was a, you know, a moto guy, then came here and did road race. And, you know, Stoner was a dirt track guy and went to road race. So there was a lot of, talent in that, you know, Sydney area of 3 or 4 hours around. I mean, Marmont's, they rode here. They had good results. You got Ty Simmons. I mean, a lot of those guys did transition, you know, out of there and had good results around the world. I mean, you've had several motocross the nations. You've done a lot of world supercrosses. So, you know, it's a pretty star-studded career, really.
Yeah, like I said, with how small this country is and the small amount of riders, it's pretty amazing to see the amount of talent that has come out of this area itself. You know, you go, Bert, he was such a talent in supercross, motocross, yeah. And then you see him just switch over to road racing the way he did, and he was exceptional on the bike. It's just many different directions that these guys all went, and they all got successful in their own right. So a great area, great era. To grow up in, you know, you yourself, Hoppo, you and Dave did a lot of traveling, took me around on 80s at the time to help me get to the supercrosses. It's very well spread out over here. So yeah, you know, it was just a great time and a great community of riders that really helped everyone charge their way through their careers.
Certainly. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, after the 85s, I mean, you progressed onto the 125s as everyone did in two strokes back then. And you started with the Suzuki team. You were on Suzuki's for a long time.
Yeah. So my first Suzuki, I think, was a 1990 model on the 85s. Mm-hmm. Actually, it might have even been an 89 model. And basically just stayed with Suzuki for quite a long time. At the end of my junior career, so we're 15 is junior, 16 we turned to senior. At my end of the junior career, we started getting a bit more support out of Suzuki, switched over to my first senior year, and I was, you know, at the time, you wouldn't call it a factory team or anything like that, but it was the Suzuki team. I was the 125 rider on the Suzuki team. So, yeah, we were with them for quite a long time. That was in 95, my last year on Suzuki at that point. But yeah, I felt like it gelled so much. And even still now, when I jump onto a Suzuki, there's a very familiar feel about the bike that you just brings back the memories and the feel that you're so used to when you get out there. So a long time on them, you know, won junior national titles, won many supercross races, motocross races on the 125 on a Suzuki when I turned 16. And we went straight into the big leagues. There was no, like we see today, no development classes like there would have been in America, I'm sure. But just straight into racing against all the top riders. And to come out and get some victories straight up like that was pretty impressive for the senior rankings for us over here.
So when first thing that comes to mind when I think of Australian motocross athletes, and I think maybe this is a commonality that maybe you can speak to countrywide, is that when I, for lack of better terms, Australian athletes are not to be fucked with. Like there's a certain like tenacity that comes with the successful athletes that come out of that country. It's a hardiness. It's a thirst to want to compete, continue to prove yourself. Is that something that's sort of instilled in young athletes in that country to begin with? Or is that more or less a commonality among successful athletes, no matter where they come from?
I think that surely it'd be something that's common across anywhere, wherever they come from. I don't think it's something for Australians that is instilled into them, but I think it's just the environment that we grow up in, the way that everyone's brought up. It's sort of just as a natural development of everyone that, you know, when they try to strive and push themselves to get better at what they do, you know, it doesn't matter what sport it is. We see it with swimmers here in Australia. They're incredibly talented and very good at what they do. When you get onto the world scene, you look at the road bike rider, it doesn't matter where you look, there's always an Australian that's pushed themselves so hard in the sport that they love. And I just think it's the environment that they grow up in, knowing that we are only a small part of the world. And if we want to put ourselves onto that pedestal, we really need to push ourselves pretty damn hard to make it happen. So I think that's just a natural progression of where we are.
Yeah, I think it's just like a chip on the shoulder that whether it's placed there by one of your competitors or you put it on there yourself just to want to continue to prove yourself and prove it to everybody else. The country of Australia and your athletes seem to harness that probably better than any other country. And that includes with football or, rugby, you name it. It's something that I just like across the board, I see a lot of it. Do you see that a lot in the, you see that consistently or continuing on with the younger generation? Or is that something that, maybe needs to be instilled a little bit more?
Yeah, the younger generation. Do we want to go there?
I would love to if you'd like to.
I mean, I
don't know.
I was just going to add to a little previously to where, like, you know, when I remember, and I've said this several times on this podcast, it's like, hey, when I was younger, or the younger generation back then, I mean, we waited 3 months for motocross action, dirt bike, any of that stuff to come, right? Mm. And we would thumb through it for hours. Or, you know, Ricky Johnson's motivational video, you know, someone had it and there was 20 copies made. And, you know, we just watched that. We would go to Coffs Harbour Supercross with Ben Linscott and watch it over and over and over, right? And I think that set the precedent of, yes, everyone loved Australia and wanted to be there, but there was always that dangling carrot that there was something bigger and better. And to do that, you had to leave.
Yeah.
Because I had this conversation with Cody Mackey one day and, you know, regardless of where we are and there's borders and countries and legality and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I was lucky pre 9/11, how I ended up here and got legal and worked and all that sort of stuff. That's a whole different story. But, you know, Mackey's straight up. He goes, I wish I'd left straight away, regardless of legality, regardless of anything. He said, I should have left 10 years earlier than what I did. And I think that, you know, sometimes you have to make those sacrifices. I mean, you look at Gardner or any of those guys, the road race guys. I mean, there was always a connection somewhere to somebody that would help them leapfrog or leverage into a better position. But, you know, there's all, to me, there was always that carrot or it's like, oh man, the US is where it's at, or it's the GPs or whatever. Like, you really had to push to make that sort of happen.
I think with the younger generation at the moment, yeah, look, there's always going to be the one person out there, or two people, three people, whatever it might be, that has that drive, that passion, that wants to do it. But it just seems a little too easy for a lot of these younger generations at the moment. They don't, not as many, I don't think, have that real desire to want to go out there and push themselves and be that next rider that gets overseas and is successful. Of course, there's always going to be one or two here and there, but overall, I think just the younger generation seem to be happy at what they're doing. I don't know. I don't know if that's just the way it is now, or if there's a bit of desire that's been lost to go and better themselves overseas, become that world champion. I'm not sure. It just doesn't seem as much. In saying that, don't get me wrong, there is a lot, especially now that we're seeing, you know, the 85s back in the Supercross. We're starting to see some incredible talent that's coming through. I feel we've had a bit of a hole in Australia of recent years for talent coming through. And I think over the next 5 years, Australia is turning back around and it is going to be a very strong talent pool to pick from over here. So I think, ask me again in 5 years, maybe it's going to be a different answer. I think we do have some good stuff coming through, but just at the moment, I think it's just a little bit lackluster.
Fair enough. So do you think that having two athletes at the absolute precipice of the top of the heap in international motocross with the Lawrence brothers right now, having those guys at the absolute peak and able to race with the best and be the best, knocking down multiple championships, do you think that is the proof in the pudding that some of the young kids back in Australia might need to see, like, hey, we can do it too? And that if no better proof than the fact that those two guys have shown the world that a couple of kids from Australia can make something special happen.
Well, I think it really impacts the younger rider more So, right, looking at the Lawrence brothers, like you said, they look at them and go, yep, we can do that now. I think the guys that are, you know, you're 15, 16, just going into seniors that had the talent, but, you know, they're kind of past that point of where you have that real desire to say, yep, I really want to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts early. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with the 85 riders, especially, you know, we've got the 65 Cubs, we've got the 85s, and everyone does it around the world. I think that that is the real influential part of the rider pool that you need to be in to incorporate that skill set and really have that desire to go forward. So I think, like I said, over the next 5 years, I think what you've just said with the Lawrences, it's really going to drive a lot of them younger riders. And I think we are going to see more and more of those riders take on the world.
That being said, if you had a group of 85, 65 riders from Australia in front of you right now, and you had to give them some advice or maybe a piece of tough love to have them grab grass and growl and drop their lap times and progress, what would you tell them?
Don't override the bloody bike. You see it a lot. They've got such a will and want to win that you see them sometimes forgetting some of the basics that you kind of need to really continue to move forwards, the smoothness, just being completely in control the whole time. Like you see with the Lawrences, they are so calculated with what they do. They are very smooth at what they do. They do get out of control every now and then, but they pull it back into line really quick. So their riding is very, very controlled. And I think that that's something I've always thought is key, being that smoother rider. It probably didn't get me as far as I probably should have done, but I always felt that that was a strength that really, over the last few years in America, you would have to think that was lost a little bit with your Bubba Stewart era or your Ricky era, where they were pushing themselves so hard, but they were fine to do it. Now I think we're seeing a little bit more of a calculated era with the way the Lawrences are riding out on the track. They seem so much more in control at what they do. They're not really putting themselves on the edge, or it doesn't appear to be as on the edge as much as we have seen in the past.
I think that some of that, and I think Brad and I have spoke about this before, and I see it in Australia as well, is that I think that the bikes, the tires, the chassis and everything has allowed that to, you know, you look at the body English of someone from Loretta's, and then I see the same sort of style on the internet as a kid in Australia. Not that I know all the names, but I still watch. And I think that it's some of that, because we all have these eras, right? You know, Johnson, Stanton, Bale, whatever you go through. But, and I think that the development of the bikes and the tires and the chassis has definitely allowed those guys the next level as well. But they are very calculated, like you said, very calculated.
Yeah, I'll say this on Jet Lawrence is, I think the scariest thing about his dominance of some of the championships he's been in is that he always seems to, like, his riding style tells me there's more in the tank at all times. And yeah, that is a scary proposition for those who are trying to catch him when, like, someone looks like they're jogging and you're sprinting and you're not making up any ground. And that is something that I think from what everyone that I've talked to on the chassis side of things, the best way to ride a 450 is to have it be calm and not to upset the chassis nearly as much or as minimal as possible. That's how those guys ride that bike. That's how those guys win.
Well, you're fresh from Motocross the Nations. I mean, you watched him and Tiger go at it.
Yeah, and both those guys have Tim Geiser has a little bit more of an erratic style. I think it's a lot more tamed down than it was when he was on 250s. I think he was maybe one of the most active on the bike when he was on 250s. I think he's calmed down quite a bit over the last few years. Both guys are, they're surgeons when it comes to racing dirt bikes. And it was shown in full color when you have every notable race won by a Honda. Those two guys made it look easy. So Hammy, and I guess that's a great nickname, by the way. Like, has everyone just been calling you Hammy since the beginning of time?
Hambone. There's also
Hambone. Sorry. How did it come to be that a young man from Australia would forge his way into some pretty notable positions throughout the 90s and the 2000s. That would have taken a lot of mental fortitude to force yourself into the limelight, including one of my favorite segments in Terra Firma, which is, I think, if anything put you on the map internationally, that had to be it.
Yeah, it's funny. I still hear that, even to these days, that particular part in Terra Firma is a favorite for a lot of people. I'd have to give all the credit to Craig Dak Racing, honestly.
Yeah.
I joined his team when I was 17 in 1996. I guess previous to that, though, McGrath came out with the Knack Knack, right? That was the start of everything. And I was pretty much one of the first, if not the first rider in Australia to start taking on the freestyle persona. Not that I ever considered myself a freestyler. I was always a racer that just did stuff. But yeah, you know, just the tricks and stuff that I was doing at the time, I guess, allowed me to be noticed. But joining Craig Dak was the most professional outfit in Australia at the time. My media commitments went through the roof. There was no official training as far as with media or anything like that, but it was something that I was always good with speaking from an early age. I did commentary with my dad at the local races, Cessnock Motocross Club, anything like that. My squeaky little kid voice going over.
Go ahead.
All good. Got it.
Yeah. So yeah, just doing the commentary and stuff like that, I started to pick up the way you needed to be speaking in front of a camera. It came naturally to me. And then just being part of that team, I think that was something that really assisted with my progression, my professionalism with what I did. At the time, we were sponsored by Fox, Craig Dak. I don't know what kind of deal he had with Fox, but we managed to get, you know, a limited edition set of Fox gear back then, which was kind of unheard of, really. It was a set of gear that no one else around the world had. And I really don't know how the whole connection with Terra Firma came about. It would be something to do with the sponsorship, with the team. And then they were, you know, come out to America. We want to do some filming with you. Of course, kid of my age, 17 years old, hasn't done that much traveling around the world. Man, I was pretty pumped about it.
Sign me up. And yeah. I think that is something like the Terra Firma videos and that whole era is something that is such a time capsule, because we don't have that anymore. We don't have, I was talking to Davey Coombs about this. We don't have scarcity anymore in the sport. Like every race, there is more footage that comes out of a random Australian supercross than there is of like the entire 1996 season. And, yeah. So when it did come out, whether it was Terra Firma or Krusty, or you had a couple of videos that were never more than maybe 35 minutes, 40 minutes tops, kids like me and like you guys as well were just like, play it again, play it again, play it again. And it was those brands that were front-facing, and then they would, obviously those were the brands that supported this whole thing, that you're like, I'm getting that much enjoyment out of it. I'm supporting the brands that support the sport. And I think that's really what cemented Fox, not only in my mind, but across and around the world, as one of the most preeminent brands. They always had great stuff, but they were also responsible for bringing that action to your living room, and then you rewind it and watch it again.
Like Hoppo said, the fact that we didn't have that at our fingertips every single day, it was such an exciting time when you knew a new Terra Firma or Krusty Demons was coming out. You just could not wait to watch it. And like you said, over and over and over, you'd watch it and watch it. And then you'd go out and ride and you'd be so pumped from it. It was a completely different era to what we see right now. And it's hard to explain to the younger generation just how cool that was to be able to go and do that. The excitement of it. They don't appreciate what we had back then with the fact that we had to wait. And when we did, we were so excited about it. It's all just given to them so easy now with social medias. And look, social media is great, don't get me wrong, for getting the coverage and everything out there. But it was a different mindset back then.
Yeah, like when the shot on Stockton Beach, Hammy, who organized that and who shot it and all that sort of stuff? How did that come about? Like, they did they use a camera crew from Australia, or do they fly someone out from the US and you'll go, hey, let's go down to Stockton Beach, man. I got some sand dunes for you.
Pretty sure it was Australian camera crew. Mm-hmm. Fox guys, I think Pete Fox, yeah. I may be wrong, actually was here at the time. And it was organized and coordinated through them. They knew the vision that they wanted to get, but they just had the local talent as far as the cameraman of how it all happened. And, it, you know, the Stockton Dunes day, it was absolutely pissing down rain, absolutely yeah. flogging down rain. So it was something that, you know, it's not ideal for going out and shooting, but thankfully we decided that we would shoot the dunes on that day. Back then, the dunes were pretty easy to get into. There was some restrictions, and there was rangers there that patrol the sand dunes and find the wrong people. But we'd been out the dunes that many times before that we befriended the ranger, and he was always part of what we did. That when we came out to shoot that time, it all went very smoothly. I'm sure there was some official stuff that had to be done to be able to do it. I don't know who organized that. Again, I feel that could have been through the team mm-hmm. coordinating with Fox itself. So, yeah, you know, there would have been some stuff like that that had to be sorted. And then the additional parts to it where we went to Faraway's and to Hillsborough Quarry, they were just a camera dude turned up to me, come on, let's go and shoot. So we just organized it ourselves. Hillsborough Quarry, I know. There's that one shot of me jumping up a hill that does not do it justice. I did that jump literally twice. That was it. Yeah. It was the stupidest jump ever. It was completely blind. The person on the top where I almost landed him, he's standing up there, so I knew where the hell to jump to. There was no way of knowing where to go. And that was coming in fourth gear, front wheel, barely stay on the ground because it was over a bit of a rise. It was a dumb jump. And I really wish I got some footage from the bottom to show just how crazy it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was Hillsborough Quarry. It was some fun times out there.
So after that, they brought you to the US. You hung out with Metzger. You did a road trip. Yep. I mean, for you, that would have, I mean, I was here at the time, but I don't remember you being here to do the movie because no one had cell phones. You had to have landline dial, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on there. So that really dates yourself. But you hung out with Metzger for a long time.
Yeah. So that was a real eye opener. You know, I looked up to Metzger being this lord of freestyle and even with racing and everything, you know, as I said, I hadn't done much traveling. I'd never been into America with bikes before. So, you know, it was pretty cool to do that, but I was blown away. I was gobsmacked when I was there, you know, trying to see the things that happen from their point of view, from American's point of view, from a filming point of view. I'm sure Metzger had done plenty of films with them before. So it was all very new to me and I was just doing my best to keep up, which brought me on the ground a few times, but you know, it's part of it, right?
That's right in around I think that's a year or so before the filming of Fresno Smooth. Yeah. So you guys are like, what's like to me, like I'm a few years younger than you guys. So you're always older to me, but like you guys were kids at the time. Like, yeah. Like I was watching Terra Firma as I was packing for World Vets and there's not a single hair on your chin, my friend. Yeah. You were, fresh-faced kid just going out on an adventure and making some memories along the way.
Yeah, it was very much like that. Again, as far as, you know, looking up to those guys, the year previous to that, we did the North Queensland Supercross Championship.
Right.
Again, that was part of the 24, 26, whatever Supercross that was. And they had Brian Deegan and Metzger come out and race that. So I was racing Deegan and Metzger on 125s prior to that. Okay. I didn't know the guys at the time. You know, they were just big American stars to me in my eyes. So I'd never even spoken to them. But then, yeah, to get that trip over there and then hang out with Metzger was pretty cool. I was probably like that young, annoying kid, you know, the fan that was just off to the side, hanging out, trying to get in Metzger's ear, trying to figure out what to do.
I'm sure throughout your travels, you have fans come up to you all the time. I'm sure a lot of them bring up Terra Firma, some bring up some of your Australian stuff. What is a memory or a race that gets brought up by a fan that always that you're always eager to talk about? Is there one particular one or one that is there any deep cuts that like that a fan's brought up that you're like, holy crap, I barely remember that myself?
Oh, I don't remember much of my racing career, actually. There's been way too many hits to the head.
DTE is real. Okay, perfect.
Yeah, it is pretty bad. The one race that does get brought up a lot is, and I'm sure you've seen, I'm sure everyone's seen it, is the race from Melbourne Supercross that's on YouTube where Craig Anderson and I come together. As I said, we had a rivalry that went back into juniors. It got very heated at the end of juniors, so much so that the governing body called us in to straighten us out, said, you boys need to pull your pants up and stop being absolute idiots because we are going to fine you if this continues on. And that just went through to seniors. That rivalry was always there. And it blew up that night in Melbourne. So much so that, again, we got called back into the governing body. And, yeah, it got real.
What was the year when you first were asked to ride for Australia to represent the motocross nations?
I only did it once. And that was in 2005.
Were you on a two-stroke or a four-stroke?
Four-stroke at that time. I was 2005. I was on the 450. I was for Australia, and I know that American guys still hadn't done it. I'd been racing in Germany prior to that, and I'd seen the 450s in Supercross over there. The first year I went over there, I was on a 250, watched all the 450s. And if you know the ground over there, when they do their Supercrosses, it is so wet and sticky. And
it's like Play-Doh.
Yeah. It saps the power out of the bike. So a 250 was really struggling against the 450. So I decided in 2005 I would jump onto the 450 for the entire series. I was the only pro rider that was on a 450 for our Supercross series. Matt McKenna was the only other four-stroke that was in Supercross on 450 at the time. But yeah, in 2005, that was my best motocross result for the year. I tied actually Anderson for fourth place in the championship. But it was a bit of a luck for me that year. I think Reedy had an issue. Berner had an issue. There was a lot of guys that couldn't make it. I always said I was the best of what was left out of everyone. So yeah, we're just the leftovers that made it across to that. But it was still a cool event to get to represent Australia. At Ernie, that atmosphere is just insane over there. Even in 2004, it was just nuts.
Yeah, no, that race is a bucket list event for any professional racer to be able to participate. And by hook or by crook, you beat Antonio Caroli. I don't know what happened to him that day, but
he had a shit day then.
Yeah, he must have had a pretty shit day. But yeah, like behind you in the results, either way. But it must have meant a lot to you. Like I went over to Matterley Basin this last year, just a month ago, and watched the Australian boys hoist the Chamberlain Trophy. I'm sure there were some shoeys involved. A banner day for Australia, and I'm sure a very proud moment for both of you.
Yeah, it was cool to see. Australia's been at it for so many years trying to get that top step. You know, we've had a lot of good riders. You're still there. A lot of good riders.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's right. We had a lot of good riders that have tried in the past. You know, you got your Reedies, your Burns, you've had Metcalfs, you've had so many talented Mossy. Riders that Mossy really could have done it. They just didn't get there. So to see them boys finally do it was pretty cool. And I know it was massive hype back here in Australia. People were up because that was, 1, 2 in the morning when it was happening, something like that. And everyone was up watching it. It was a big event for a lot of the Australian motocross community.
Awesome. Wrap it up here with a couple of questions for you. Are you an avid reader?
I do a little bit, not too much. I don't think I find enough time to be able to.
As do most of, not only everyone on this call, but most people do. But if there's a book that you've read over the past few years that had some impact on you, what would it be?
God, I don't know. I don't read enough to give you a solid answer that's actually going to be worthy of anything here.
Fantastic.
Hey, just honest truth, buddy.
Well, yeah. So you keep yourself pretty busy, and you're always juggling a lot of things. What is it that you find allows you to keep all of those balls in the air? Is it keep staying organized? Is it waking up first thing in the morning? Is it taking care of your rest? What is it?
No, just the organization of it, I guess. There is a lot of things going on. The day job that I have, just in an excavation business, takes up a majority of my time. So yeah, just juggling around that, you know, from just so you've got the schedule from here. As I said, I go to America, land, go straight to Adelaide. I'm home for a day, go across to Perth for the Supercross, the WSX over there, come home for a night, go down to Melbourne to start build that track. And then from there across to Abu Dhabi for the last of the WSX. So just trying to juggle that in, making sure I know where I'm going to next is all I need to know. So it's, it can be a bit of a juggling act, but there is a lot going on at the moment.
Last couple questions I have for you then. Where can people follow along to stay up on all things Danny Ham?
Danny.ham.motocross on my socials. They'll definitely be able to keep up with anything that we got going on. That's certainly where I'll be out posting to piss off any of the other riders. That's what I like to do every now and then. Just anything there. That's the best place to keep following up on my stuff. There's not a lot of stuff that goes up. Unless it's something worthy of putting up, I try to stay clear of it a bit, but I definitely do try to add some content every now and then to make sure that I'm still stay relevant.
Absolutely. And then when, in 1 year's time, when I line up for World Vets, in the plus 35 intermediate, you're going to be lining up next to me or no?
I don't know if I'll step down an age, but I do, Hoppo, just so you know now. Yeah, I am thinking again next year we might be making the trip back over for World Vets. I had an absolute ball there the last time. It's wrecked my riding here in Australia because I've come back from riding such cool tracks over there that I just don't find the enjoyment as much over here at the moment.
We will have a full house, won't we?
Battling for who gets to share the air mattress. Danny, this has been awesome, man. Really appreciate you making some time on your Saturday morning.
No, thank you very much. I do appreciate it. It's cool to be able to jump onto these and just have a chat and bring back what memories I can remember anyway. With Hoppo, we've had many years of doing a lot of racing together. He even supported me through 2006 on a Honda before I blew my knee out again. So it's always great to chat and just catch up with you guys, and hopefully we can do it again.
Yeah, definitely sounds like it's going to be time for a part two. Hoppo, appreciate the time, big guy.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. Hammy, maybe we should do a round two here, maybe in the new year. But all the best for your Triumph launch. Brad, I'm glad you made it home safe and sound back to the land of Winnie the Pooh. And that's another story.
It's the most, like, he was absolutely flabbergasted. The character Winnie the Pooh comes from Winnipeg.
And that's his damn name.
We'll leave the listening audience with that nugget of information, and they're going to hit the Google on that. Sound good?
So awesome. Good. No, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
boys.